Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 4. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk all things Catherine Howard is Gareth Russell. Gareth is the author of several books, including Young and Damned and Fair, his critically acclaimed biography of Queen Catherine Howard. He studied history at Oxford and his postgraduate at Queen's University Belfast, where he completed his thesis on the Queen's household in the 1540s. He divides his time between Belfast and New York. My conversation with Gareth straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Gareth. How are you?
I'm very well, Natalie. How are you?
I'm good. Friday evening, so that's always a good thing.
Lucky you. Lucky Friday morning. Exactly. Friday morning here.
Now, I'm recording this from my study in a lovely leafy suburb of southern Sydney. Where are you currently?
Well, I am in my my study in Belfast in Northern Ireland. It's currently, it looks as if a bomb full of books has gone, has exploded in it. So it needs to be, they need to be put away quickly. I've just finished another book, so I'm on the tidy up stage. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I'll ask you about that book in a little bit. Yeah, I'm the same. I'm just staring at about probably 10 books sitting on my desk. So it's not a good thing, but you know, that's life. I was wondering if we could begin by you just telling us a little bit about your background and yourself and how you came to be interested in the Tudors.
I grew up in Northern Ireland and I loved history. I think, you know, my parents sent me to Sunday school and I loved the Bible stories and remembered sort of all the details from it. But it was on a, probably the first part of history I was really interested in was the Titanic, because it was built here. My great-grandfather, who was alive when I was born, could remember seeing it. So I sort of grew up in the race of that. Yeah. My parents and my sisters and I, when I think I was about 7 or 8 years old, we rented a cottage for the summer in Southern Ireland, and it was a sort of a rain-soaked afternoon, and the national broadcaster replayed the Genevieve Bijoult film, Anne of a Thousand Days, and my father's a Richard Burton fan, so I sort of sat with him because we couldn't go outside and play.
Yeah,
and it's the start of an obsession. So
yeah, that's one of I love that film. It's a wonderful. Beautiful film. Yeah, so fabulous. Now, you've written an excellent biography of Catherine Howard, Henry VIII's fifth, and I think often misunderstood wife. What drew you in particular to her story?
Well, it was sort of Catherine and I seemed to have been flung together by a sort of process of accidents. When I was 18 and convinced that at 18 one could write a book, which was an apocalyptic lack of self-awareness, but I'd planned to do a sort of book on six different queens in different time periods, but the only chapter I ever finished was Catherine Howard's, and I obviously now hope that no one ever finds that. I went to Oxford and did my my undergraduate and came back to Belfast to Queen's University, who have this fantastic medieval history department. And I wanted, as my dissertation, to look at the Queen's household. And I pitched an idea of looking at it really from Elizabeth Woodville right the way through to Catherine Parr. And my supervisor, Dr. James Davis, said, you know, it might be more interesting, rather than doing a broad overview, do a very specific in-depth analysis of a short period of time. So why don't you pick a queen who wasn't in charge for very long, and fortunately for historians, Henry VIII provided us with quite a few of those. And I picked Catherine because, you know, we had a household being formed, a household in residence, a household on tour, and a household collapsing. And then when I had finished, sorry, it was as I was working on that dissertation, I started to realize that through looking at her household, actually something I'd never expected became clear, which is that the trajectory and story of Catherine's own career looks very, very different from what has been presented in other studies. And that eventually led to pitching the idea of a biography of her.
Right, okay. And did you find that as you wrote, your connection to her deepened? Do you now feel that you're sort of more connected to her than to the other wives?
You know, I said, I remember at my, we had a sort of lovely sort of supper here in Belfast for the UK book launch. And I can remember at my speech saying to the people there that I really didn't like her very much.
Right,
at a certain
time.
During it, I do now, but I think during it, I you know, there were moments of kind of, you know, say 3 or 4 a.m. in the library, just almost smacking my head off my notes at some of the things that she did, particularly towards the end. But actually, I think I came to really like her a lot more. She was such a vibrant woman, and whilst some of the mistakes were just jaw-dropping, I sort of had a real breakthrough moment when I thought, well, when I was 19 or 20, I look back on some of the things I did when I was in love, and you think, like, your skin crawls.
Absolutely.
And that's what it's so easy to kind of argue that you can only sympathize with her if she was a total victim, or dismiss her if she was, a sort of promiscuous moron. And actually, I think I ended up admiring and sympathizing with her a lot more than I had initially thought I would.
Okay. Now, you've touched on this a little, but I just wanted to share. I recently Googled Catherine Howard. I don't know if you've done that in a while.
Yeah.
But I want to read to you some of the headings that came up in the first sort of few pages. Okay. So bear with me. I'm going to read some to you. So first one, was Catherine Howard, Henry VIII's, in quotation mark, wanton fifth wife, actually a victim of child sex abuse? That's number one. Then there's Catherine Howard, the material girl, question mark. Then there's Henry VIII's scandalous fifth wife. We have Catherine Howard, whore or victim. Catherine Howard, did she or didn't she? That was actually an article on my website, funnily enough. And finally, Catherine Howard confesses to adultery, which I haven't even looked into that one. That's pretty interesting. I want to know a little bit more. Now, you've already touched a little bit on the woman that you came to know during your research. But can you sort of go a little bit deeper into what kind of person she was, or what you found during your research?
Well, the first thing to note is that she the abuse theory is very popular at the minute, and it's sort of, I think, slightly disingenuously being presented as a new theory, when in fact it's a revival of Agnes Strickland's theory from the 19th century, that she was Agnes Strickland really looked at it through the prism of class, and she argued that these lower class servants that Catherine was exposed to had corrupted her morals, which obviously we wouldn't agree to at the moment. There are some really really good articles and studies of her that argue for the abuse theory. It wasn't something that I found any evidence for, so I sort of disagreed with that. And right. my gripe with that theory, by the way, is not with the historians at all who agree with it. There's a slight concern I have that people's argument is you can only sympathize with her and she's only tragic if she the victim of this abuse, for which there is, I don't think, a lot of evidence. In fact, there's quite a lot of evidence to the contrary.
Yeah.
And I actually think that in general, the idea that you can't sympathise with a young woman who was executed unless she was a victim in that sense is a little odd.
It is a little odd. Yeah, I agree.
Are you saying that if she was sexually active of her own choice, that her execution isn't also tragic, which I think is just bizarre. She was the thing that probably, Natalie, if I'm honest, that struck me that I don't think anyone has paid a lot of attention to is kind of how good she was at her job publicly.
Right. Okay, yeah, that's good.
She was, I looked a lot into kind of the curriculum for aristocratic children, and there's no point in pretending whatsoever that she's ever exposed to a curriculum as demanding or intellectually stimulating as, say, the one given to her cousin, Anne Boleyn, or to her successor, Catherine Parr.
Right.
But she seems to have been given a relatively standard education. I mean, she was certainly better educated, I think, than Jane Seymour, but she, you know, there was a lot of stress on etiquette and music and those sort of things. And what struck me is that the more and more I studied her was how often in 1540 and 1541, people were complimenting her. You know, Eustace Chapuis did it, Charles de Marillac did it. They were complimenting her and her sort of exquisite manners.
Right.
And her beautiful behavior in public, and I thought, well, that sort of showed more gravitas than people have credit for. And yet, there were also moments. There was a personality trait that I think really developed from her time in her step grandmother's care, which was that she could be quite she was very used to being the center of attention, and she was very.
Yes.
Kind of kindly but firmly controlling people around her. There was a sense of a certain star quality that she had, and she had this pathological aversion to being embarrassed or to being humiliated. I think that explains a lot of the decisions that she made during her downfall, including this kind of extraordinary moment in January 1542 when she rejects the House of Lords' offer for a trial.
Right.
Knowing Henrician government and concepts of justice, there she was probably right in thinking there was no way that she could have been acquitted. But even to most people, I think, could have, like Mary Queen of Scots did later, view a trial as a moment before history where you could say something beyond the immediate time. And Catherine didn't seem to want that, and I think she did it. I mean, that sort of, I talk a bit about it in the book, that she didn't, the embarrassment of having the details of her private life read out again. So I mean, and I think it explains that famous execution rehearsal where she rehearsed putting her head on the block over and over again the night before she died. So yeah, I mean, she was nuanced, and I liked that a lot in her.
Yeah, that's intriguing. Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? That she'd want to practice and make sure she got it perfect. I suppose her final performance, in a way. Tell me about this rose without a thorn. Where does that come from?
That comes again from the industrious, majestic pen of the Strickland sisters. It's one of those things that when I said in the book, this whole idea that she was, that we always talk about her being small and plump or small and curvaceous, that also comes from the Strickland books. It's not how anyone described her at the time. They said she was short but very thin.
Right, okay.
And people sometimes look as if you've stolen Christmas from them when you say this sort of long established view. You're like, nope. But the Rose Letter Thorn thing, there was a coin minted early in Henry the, I think it's, this one I think was the surviving ones from the early 1520s,
right.
In which they refer to the phrase, the Latin phrase, sort of the Rose Letter Thorn is on it. And Strickland, when she saw it, either genuinely believed through an error she made, or just thought it would make a good story, that this coin had been minted during Henry's honeymoon with Catherine, and it was a sort of beloved nickname for her. And it really has entered kind of popular mythology. You know, Jean Plaidy called her novel about Catherine of Rose.
That's right. Yeah, it's fascinating how these myths sort of originate, isn't it, when you look into them?
Yeah, and it's, you know, that sobriquet, Rose Letter Thorn, was a it was a medieval Catholic form of veneration for the Virgin Mary.
Right, okay.
But it also seems to have been in the coin that was minted sort of before Catherine was born, a play on the Tudor rose, and saying that they were, the dynasty was the rose that would inflict more kind of wounds on the nation. But yeah, as you say, it's fascinating. Where do these come from?
Okay, fabulous. Now, what would a day in the life of Queen Catherine Howard have been like? Yeah. How would she have spent her hours?
Well, it's sort of, I mean, obviously it would have varied slightly depending on where they were.
Yes.
You know, when you get to the smaller palaces like Woking, you're not going to have the same sort of panoply, if you like, as you would have at, say, Windsor Castle or Hampton Court or Whitehall.
Yes.
Where actually she was never in residence at Whitehall when she was queen, but she was there briefly when she was a lady in waiting. She would have woken up, and typically if her husband hadn't spent the night with her, there would of course have been one of the eight women of the privy chamber would have slept at the foot of her pallet at the end of her bed. She would have been dressing, breakfast. Usually they heard mass or religious services early in the morning, accompanied by the maids of honour. Now, sort of famously, in one of her last days as queen, Catherine went to mass in the chapel royal at Hampton Court, but that really only happens on the high holy days. Ordinarily, it's a private event. There could be another. Well, she's at mass. By the way, the servants are in getting the room sort of tidied.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Because a lot of servants slept on the floor. They slept kind of in sleeping bags. They all had to be gotten rid of. There could be petitions to be heard or audiences to have visiting diplomats. There could be a hunting trip later on. That usually obviously happens in the afternoon when the daylight's still good. Then dinner, and in the evening, from what I can tell, most audiences would have happened afterwards. They would have happened sort of, I mean, by the point when people were coming back inside.
Right, okay.
And there could be, and she, we do know that she loved to dance. The French ambassador de Marillac said that, you know, it was one of the things that she couldn't get enough of.
Right.
So I think evenings were often spent with sort of pastime and good company to quit her husband. And at 6 o'clock, if she hadn't seen her husband that day, one of his gentlemen from the Privy Chamber, Sir Thomas Heneage, would come and give her a kind of report of how her husband's day had gone.
Right.
And then there was relatively early curfew for the servants. Because once the sun was gone, I mean, really, what are you?
Yeah.
The age before electricity. So that was sort of, it was, I mean, that's not kind of the Groundhog Day, but it's close to it.
Yeah, thank you. That's really interesting. Now, what do you think personally was the nature of her relationship with Culpeper?
Yeah, well, that's sort of, that I, when I was finishing the book, I was in a library in Belfast that was open 24 hours, and I can remember sort of thinking, right, I'm going to sit down with all the evidence I have and just go over it and see. And a friend came up and said, you've been here since yesterday. You're wearing the same clothes.
Gosh. And haven't moved.
So that's when the psychosis that kind of set in. But the with Culpeper, so, you know, this would have preoccupied me for weeks, actually, of going over and over it. I argue in the book that this is not, we have to really avoid drawing too many parallels with Anne Boleyn, for whom I think her innocence is just glaringly obvious.
Yeah, absolutely.
With Catherine, it isn't. My own personal interpretation is that they hadn't slept together, but they would have. And that the relationship was going in that direction, and it was actually caught, sort of, they were caught before. And there's a significant amount of evidence from comments that were made. You know, Culpeper said more or less that in his interrogation that they hadn't, but he had been minded to, and the Queen likewise minded with him. And it was then that Edward Seymour sort of said, well, that's already too much.
Yeah, that's enough, isn't it? That's treason there. Yeah. And
you're considering it.
Yeah.
Catherine likewise did not ever buckle and say that they slept together. And looking at a lot of the comments, I mean, she wasn't actually condemned to death for adultery. She was condemned to death for intending to commit it, which under the extension of the treason laws that Henry VIII had passed when he broke with Rome, that sort of misprecision of treason, that she'd done enough, that she had done enough to be condemned of planning it. And later, you know, I find a lot of comments from Tudor courtiers expressing a certain doubt. For instance, William Thomas, who was he was a servant to John Dudley, who was Catherine's master of the horse, and he later became clerk of the council under Edward VI. And he said that she, you know, he makes a comment on Catherine that she had contaminated her virginity and after marriage had committed or at least sought means to commit adultery. That's what I think. But I do also point out in the book that Lady Rochford did, you know, she said that she, in her opinion, they had together. And there's no, you know, it's up to the reader to decide from the evidence in the book what do they think happened. I give my sort of opinion at the end.
It's difficult, isn't it? It's tricky to get your mind around it, how they, and especially thinking about Lady Rochford for a second. What do you think about Lady Rochford? Do you think reckless? Yeah. How could she involve herself in another scandal? Do you think she was just asleep when most of these things were occurring, like she claimed at some point? Or what do you think?
The asleep comment.
That's a convenient one, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know how big Catherine's bathroom was for her to have nodded off. I mean, I sort of, you know, I say in the book, look, it was very late at night. She might conceivably have. It's not hugely convincing, but it's not totally impossible either. Lady Rochford's really interesting because I think... you know, I obviously don't think that she was this sort of mentally unhinged monster that's been passed on to us. You know, I didn't find a lot of evidence for a particularly acrimonious relationship with Anne Boleyn. In fact, I think they seem to get along pretty well. But I also don't buy the theory that she felt trapped into doing it. And my friend Julia Fox, by the way, wrote a beautiful biography of Lady Rochford. I couldn't recommend highly enough. I just didn't agree totally with some of the conclusions. And likewise, Julia was very kind about Young and Damned and Fair, and she doesn't agree with a couple of mine, which is just, you know, sort of the trait of the historian.
It is, yes.
To me, I think what Julia kind of really convinced me about was that this was, you know, very much a kind of grand functioning member of the Tudor nobility. To me, Lady Rochford was, and I really, sorry, by the way, did buy Julia's theory that Lady Rochford was kind of addicted to life at court. And I think there was a certain drowning or repression of sense when she became the favourite of Catherine. I think they were both kind of addicted to gossip, although I do think actually as the affair wore on, I think Lady Rochford began to become concerned at how obvious Catherine was making her infatuation and how indiscreet they were being. There were a couple of comments she makes to the Catherine Tilney saying, you know, will you tell the Queen to stop leaving her letters lying around? That sort of thing. So, I think she wanted to be a royal favourite. I think she was addicted to sort of palace gossip. And then again, you know, this is just sort of straying into the territories of novels. I don't know if anyone's read Adrienne Delard's novel on her, but she sort of presents her as this, and obviously as a historian, Adrienne would argue, of course you can't as a historian argue this, but she kind of presents her as suffering from a sort of form of PTSD after her husband's execution and I did wonder, you know, after that many years at Henry's court, could it kind of have warped her the sense of sense, if that makes sense.
Right. Yes. That's a lot of sense there, but no, that does make sense. That's really interesting. I haven't sort of thought about it like that. And I think Henry's Court was enough to warp anyone's sense, really,
yeah,
wasn't it?
No, exactly. So yeah, I think bright but damaged.
Okay, interesting. Very interesting. Now, I think you probably know that I love to explore the story of the Tudors through the lens of the houses and the palaces and the yes. buildings where this intriguing story played out. So I wanted to ask you, Gareth, whether you have a favourite or maybe a few favourite Tudor locations.
Well, first of all, I have to say I took your In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn with me when
oh,
I was
lovely.
I did a huge kind of when I was this has been summer 2015, I think.
Yeah.
But I retraced her route through the north, and I sort of stayed only in sort of 16th century surviving inns and whatever on the way up.
Mm.
And so your book was sort of like my travel bible for a while.
Aww,
so
it's so lovely to hear. Thank you.
Well, it looks like the Rainbow Pride flag with the amount of highlighter that went into it. So it's,
love it.
I would be remiss of me not to acknowledge it. So my favorite Tudor places, you know, I find I first of all, this is, I sound like I work for their tourist board. I loved Lincoln. I really I thought Lincoln Cathedral was just one of the most extraordinary, beautiful buildings, and so much less famous than York Minster.
Absolutely. And it is beautiful, yeah.
It's stunning, and I sort of stayed at the Bishop's Palace at the foot
beautiful.
Of the hill, and was able to see the ruins of where she had stayed. So that's probably one of my favourites, and also it's very, I mean, it's impossible to beat Hever. Hever Castle is just, yeah. I think, is just achingly beautiful. But I'm trying to think, I mean, I probably will always have a huge soft spot for Hampton Court Palace.
Oh,
just because
me too, yes. Yeah.
First of all, it's, as you know, it's so kind of splendid.
It
but
is.
I was there so often because that was where she spent the residence she spent her single sort of greatest chunks of time at. You know, she spent her only Christmas there as queen.
Yes,
the announcement of her marriage was made at Hampton Court, and obviously the downfall started there. So yeah, I think probably Hampton Court will always have a special, if macabre, place in my heart.
Yeah, me too. I love Hampton Court. Now, I wanted to ask you something. I recently read quite an interesting article about history and morality. Now,
yes.
In it, the author quotes, I don't know if you know, Mark, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Mark Bloch. He was a well-known French academic and historian.
Yeah.
He was also a soldier, actually. He fought in both World Wars, and he was very heavily involved in the French resistance in World War II. Mm. Now, tragically, he was captured and killed by the Gestapo in the final weeks of Nazi occupation in France. But just before he was killed, he actually finished a chapter that would later appear in his book, and I don't know if you've read it, but it's called The Historian's Craft. Mm. The chapter itself was entitled Judgment or Understanding, I believe. And in this, he asks whether it's the historian's job to judge or to understand on the basis of the evidence collected. And he concludes that the historian should actually avoid moral judgment. Now, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to hear what you thought about this, whether you think it's actually possible to examine the past, to write about the past without judging it. it's a tricky one. I know it's controversial.
Yeah,
it's tricky, but
because you can certainly, you can certainly run away with it. You can certainly impose modern standards on something that it has no bearing on. But I think it's a bit like acknowledging Banquo's ghost. You have to acknowledge that there are certain things that will impact you more. And there are certain things that, that as a historian, I think you just have to admit that you will judge them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think actually probably the books that I have read where my mouth has hit the floor at how biased they have been have been almost without fail books that started with the historian saying, I have no bias whatsoever.
Right.
So I think, and also there are things in history that are so unutterably horrific, and not just, you know, sorry, so unutterably horrific that they should be judged, partly because I have this sort of, I have this slight frustration when you're mentioning sort of like some sort of horrific massacre in which thousands of people were slaughtered, and someone says, well, you can't judge them by the standards of today, not by their own standards, and it was still bad.
And it was still horrific, yeah, that's right.
But there are certain things I think we should just be open enough about that we can judge. But yes, he's completely right that we shouldn't carry solipsism a bit of, you know, like of only viewing the world through our own prism. So it's it's probably the eternal question of the history. Trade. How much of yourself do you bring, and how much of your own society do you bring? So certainly, I think we've probably gotten to the stage where people over-contextualize. And you know, I had people sort of once I got into an argument with someone who was trying to say that Henry's treatment of his second wife Anne Boleyn after her miscarriage, when he sort of berated her, was totally acceptable by standards. And I was like, well, first of all, it's still the actions of an incredibly cruel person.
And it was also
noteworthy enough that someone felt the need to write it down and say he went into her bedroom and screamed at her for losing a child. I actually think sometimes maybe a little bit more judgment wouldn't be a bad thing.
Okay, thank you. No, that's very interesting. Now, Gareth, we're coming to the end of our episode, so means it's time to play 10 to go. Are you ready?
Hey.
As ready as you can be, because you probably don't know what I'm about to say. No, all good, all easy. Yeah. So, number one, name two items on your bucket list.
Oh, I want to see Neuschwanstein, Ludwig II's castle in Bavaria, and I would like to spend the winter in Vermont.
Oh, that sounds nice. You do quite a bit of travelling, don't you?
I do, yes. And I was in Vermont actually for a book tour for this, but it was sort of just the tail end of winter and it was so beautiful that I thought I have to go back and get a log cabin and just wear flannel.
Well, that sounds nice. I like it. Okay, number two, what do you do to recharge?
Oh, mortifyingly. Well, the picturesque bit is if I can, I go up to a little beach house, a little sort of Irish cottage on the north coast of Northern Ireland, which is in a little village called Port Ballantrae. The more mortifying bit is I watch trash TV, like not anything worthwhile. I can't even, like reality TV, that kind of stuff. And I just think it is the perfect brain-numbing anecdote, but I won't say which ones because I want to preserve some credibility.
All right, good. Sounds good. What are you currently reading? Or you're probably reading multiple things. What's one of the things you're reading?
I've just finished a book called The Hunt for Queen Mary, which is a collection of interviews that her biographer in the 1950s, James Pope Hennessy, put together, and they couldn't be published for 50 years.
Right.
And then the next book I have up to read is a book called The President's Club, and it's about this exclusive club of ex-presidents of the United States. I'm very excited to read it.
That sounds interesting, yeah. What's a day in your life when you're writing like? Do you have any rituals? Is there somewhere you sit, a study, or are you kind of a cafe writing person?
I've become slightly peripatetic and move around a bit. But yeah, generally I try to get up and I have the Rosetta Stone Italian kit, and I'm sort of teaching myself that. And I try and do that for about half an hour in the morning because it sort of, it starts your brain. And then I don't usually have breakfast because I find it makes me a bit sleepy. So I hold off until lunch and then try to work through until either it's either a 6 p.m. day or a 10 p.m. day, and I do try to sleep because I think it's really important. Yeah,
gosh, that's a long day of writing.
Yeah, sometimes it really feels even longer.
Yeah, I can imagine. And no wine o'clock in there. That's a bit sad.
No, I think I just become a functioning alcoholic. So I.
Okay, well, this might be the answer to my next question. Is there something that most people don't know about you?
Yeah, what time to confess? Something that people don't know about me. Well, my first two books were like sort of young adult comedies set in Belfast, and they were adapted for theatre. And they're probably those adaptations for theatre are probably the thing that still makes me smile the most when I look back on my career. Aww. So yeah,
was that popular? Was it quite popular?
Yes, it was popular. Probably was the first one. Yes, it was, and I made a lot of great friends out of it. So it was just a kind of gift that kept on giving. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I think you've touched on this one with your what you do to recharge, but what is your guilty pleasure?
Guilty pleasure. Well, apart from that,
apart from that, trash TV.
Diet Coke. I mean, it's it's just, I mean, at this point, it might be about 50-60% of my bloodstream.
It's so good to meet another addict. Like, really, I'm really trying to give up. But see, I'm a Coke Zero. Do you have Coke Zero in Ireland?
Yeah, we do. We do, and I feel like I feel like so disproportionately virtuous when I order it instead of Diet Coke, and it and it really doesn't make any difference. But yeah, no, I get it. Look, I mean, you're in my prayers, Natalie, but I don't think that the black goodness is letting us go till we die.
I know. And they've actually just, this is completely, you know, not relevant to anything Tudor, but in Australia they have pulled Coke Zero off the shelf. So I'm really scared because I'm thinking, wait,
why
have they done? I don't know. It's so popular, and they've just said, oh no, it's not that popular. But that is not true. Conspiracy people. So I'm worried. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm scared.
It's still here. You know, next time you're in the UK, just bulk buy.
Yeah, good point. Okay,
like, that's ship it home.
I'm making a note of that. all right, what was I up to now? Lost my place. Oh, what's the best piece of advice, or a piece of advice that you've ever been given that you thought, yep, this is good?
Best piece of advice. It was from a professor of mine actually at Oxford who passed away recently. And when I was there, he said, get out of your own way.
Oh, I like that one. Yeah. That is good. Yeah. That's so true. That's what we do, don't we? We get in our
way. Absolutely. Get out of your own way.
I think we've answered. What's your drink of choice? Let's not talk about Diet Coke. We're going to move on. Let's go alcoholic. What's your alcoholic drink of choice?
Ooh, I do like a neat whiskey, and a good gin and tonic is hard to beat. And Guinness. I realize I'm listing loads, but I mean, it really depends on the mood. Guinness is a good fireside drink, it's good to have it when you're in Ireland. But a neat whiskey.
Whiskey. We'll go with that. What's your go-to karaoke song?
Oh, I don't have any, and the reason is that I know, Natalie, really, I mean, I kind of got to the point where I used to mime hymns in church. Like, I cannot carry a tune in a bucket. I wouldn't inflict that on.
That's the point of karaoke. Come on, you'll have to change that.
No, it's not like fun bad. it's like dying walrus bad. So,
okay, that's fine. Let's go to number 10. So what characteristics do you most value in others?
Reliability. Mm. I suppose everyone says loyalty, but I find a certain sort of spark or joie de vivre, like a sort of a passion for life, a kind of, charm or something. It's that indefinable spark in someone. I just think it when you see it, is wonderful. Yeah.
It is wonderful, and it's contagious too, isn't it, to be around those people?
It really is. It really is.
Which is lovely. All right, final question. Gareth, your Tudor takeaway. What is your Tudor takeaway for our listeners today?
Well, so I was thinking about this, because this is the one I had a heads up on.
You do, this the only one you had a heads up on.
So I thought, I was like, make this good in case the other 10 you have like a car crash series of answers. So I sort of, when I'm doing books, Natalie, I put together playlists to listen to. And the one that I'd forgotten that I listened to so much for Young and Damned and Fair, which I so recommend, is the soundtrack by Dario Marinelli to the movie Agora. It has such a sense of kind of sadness and injustice, and it was just such a beautiful, haunting soundtrack to write the final few chapters of Young and Damned and Fair with. So I would heartily recommend it for people who maybe want something to accompany their Tudor reading. And there's no lyrics, which makes it a lot. I don't listen to music with lyrics when I'm writing.
No, I know, that's a bit confusing. I love that. I've written that down, and I am going to have a listen straight after this.
Okay,
thank you so much for your Tudor takeaway, and thank you so much for talking Tudors with me. This has been so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah, Natalie, thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
I've really enjoyed it too, and I hope that you'll come back and chat to me again soon.
I will, absolutely.
All right, enjoy your day, Gareth.
You too.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.